I'm here with Tor Eklund, the attorney for Andrew Auernheimer and Matthew Keyes, and we're going to talk about the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. So just a little background before we get into the conversation. If, you know, here on the Loopcast, we've dealt with information security mostly from a practitioner's view, as people being hired to do red teaming, vulnerability assessment, and pen testing, or people who come out of government and work for private companies. And we haven't touched on the legal issues yet. So today we're going to sort of delve into, you know, why the law matters, why, you know, the legal aspect of information security and, you know, digital security in the United States matters. So let me start off with, before we get into sort of a legal conversation, update us on Andrew's state. You know, he's been in federal prison, and, you know, how is he adjusting to prison? You know, is he getting his letters? I think the last time we heard, he wasn't getting a gluten-free meal, you know, gluten-free diet. And, you know, walk us through, update us on this.
Well, he's getting his gluten-free meals finally. I think part of the problem is that they were transferring him between places. And then, you know, when he finally did get settled, he's at Allenwood Low Federal Correctional Institute, which is in Pennsylvania. It's about 180 miles outside of New York City, right off of Highway 80. He's doing okay, as, you know, one can do in a federal prison. He was in administrative segregation for a while because he had been tweeting from prison using the federal prison email system called Corelinks. He was sending out emails to people telling them to tweet, and the government got mad about that. And then he was posting messages to SoundCloud, via the telephone. So they suspended his telephone privileges. They put him in what's called the SHU, which is the special housing unit, which is essentially you share your cell with, you know, your 10 by 10 cell with one other person. You're in the cell pretty much all the time. You get out like three times a week for 15 minutes to take a shower. He was in there. They gave him a disciplinary hearing, and they sentenced him to 30 days solitary and 6 months suspension of his phone privileges. And we were getting ready to sue. And, I was talking to, a well-known prison litigator from the Seventh Circuit. And then all of a sudden they let him out of SHU, and they put him back in the general population. So that's a little bit better. But now it's my understanding that they're having him work double shifts, which is unusual for a federal prison. I think I haven't heard back from him yet on this. I just wrote him a few days ago. He's working a couple 8-hour shifts. He's only getting 4 hours of sleep a night. So that kind of strikes me as a little bit punitive, but at least now when you go to visit him, you don't have to see him behind the glass and talk to him through a phone. I haven't seen him since he got out of SHU. A friend of mine, a friend of his, went and saw him. She said that he's also lost a bit of weight and whatnot. As for his mail, he's not getting all of it, which is interesting, and they've been opening the legal mail, which is interesting. So we're trying to deal with that. But, he gets a lot of mail, he gets a lot of books, and apparently it's not all getting to him.
So how would you, are you getting regular access to him, to Andrew?
Yeah, I've had access to him. At the beginning I had to jump through some bureaucratic hoops, but I haven't actually been out to see him. I just haven't had time since he got out of the SHU. I'm probably going to try to go see him, sometime actually this week. You got to go through a lot of, I was a lawyer, so it was a little bit easier for me, but if you're a regular visitor, you got to go through a lot of paperwork. They do a background check on you, and the prison won't confirm that they put you on his visitor list until you get there. you know, unless Andrew manages to get a letter to you and tell you that. And he's also limited, I think, in the number of people that he can have on his visitor list. I think it's like 5 or something like that.
So let's sort of, you know, get to the legal issues here. You know, walk us through, you know, a background of Weave's case. I mean, for those, you know, who aren't familiar with, you know, why Weave was sort of charged under the CFAA, you know, walk us through the background. I mean, this is a fairly controversial case.
It was a very controversial case. essentially what happened is in, you know, the iPad came out in, what was it, January 2010. So there was all this, you know, hype and hysteria around the iPad. And AT&T was the exclusive service provider, wireless service provider for the iPad. And AT&T had this unlimited data plan that you could get with the iPad. And one of Weave's co-defendants who went and pleaded guilty, he wanted to get this data plan. It's unlimited data plan, but he didn't want to fork up the money for an iPad. So essentially what he did is he spoofed an iPad with his with some other wireless device, and he registered with AT&T, and he noticed that after he, you know, registered, you know, with AT&T's iPad servers, that when his device logged into AT&T's iPad servers, he would get a login window, and in the login window, his email address was automatically populated, and then underneath his email address, there was a password prompt. You know, the window was asking for a password. So this guy, Daniel Spittler, was like, oh, that's interesting. How do AT&T's iPad servers know to pre-populate my email address? He discovered essentially that it was recognizing the AT&T's iPad servers were recognizing the ICC ID number from his SIM card, you know, and that's just basically, it's called a integrated circuit card identification number. It's just a serial number printed on the SIM card. You can readily find the format on the internet. AT&T sells SIM cards with the ICC IDs printed on them. So once he realized that the servers were recognizing his ICC ID and publishing his email address, he was like, well, that's kind of interesting. What happens if I increment the ICC ID by one? And he discovered, you know, if he incremented the ICC ID, he would get, AT&T servers would publish email addresses of people who matched that ICC ID. There was no password protection. There was no, you know, pop-up windows warning him, you know, oh, you shouldn't be doing this. At trial, AT&T readily admitted that these were, you know, publicly facing servers. So Spittler goes and writes a script to automate this process, right? And this is really no different than just entering in, you know, a URL string, you know, in a web browser and querying AT&T servers. So he writes a script to automate this process. He collects around roughly 114,000 email addresses paired with these ICC ID numbers. He goes to Weave in an IRC where, you know, Weave was part of Goatsy Security, and he tells Weave about this, and, you know, Weave's all like, oh, wow, this is exciting, this is big news. A day after hearing about it, Weave essentially takes this story to Gawker, and Gawker, you know, runs a redacted list of these email addresses and ICC ID numbers. This is like roughly June 10th, no, when did he go to Gawker? Like June 8th, 2010. I think like June 15th and June 16th, because this hits the press, everyone's hyperventilating, because it's, you know, the iPad, and oh, he's got Mayor Bloomberg's email address, so he's got, you know, Rahm Emanuel's email address. So around June 15th, June 16th, the FBI kicks in his door in Arkansas, and he's arrested, and this whole saga began.
So he's charged under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act.
So yeah, he's charged under, well, technically the count is a conspiracy to violate the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, but the issue in this case really just turns around whether or not the harvesting of email addresses from AT&T's iPad servers, whether that constitutes unauthorized access to a protected computer under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. And the problem with the notion of, you know, unauthorized access under the CFAA is the CFAA nowhere defines what authorized access means. So nobody knows what the fuck it means. And the courts are, there's a circuit split in the federal courts over the meaning. And so you start to see these, you see a couple things, you see these really, what I consider to be aggressive CFAA prosecutions, you know, by the government as to, you know, what some people would think is normal computer behavior. And I think this is the central issue in Lee's case. The government's arguing, no, it's criminal. You're seeing these interpretations of the Computer Fraud Abuse Act where they say violating the terms of service of a website means your access is unauthorized, which means all of a sudden you've violated, you know, the terms of service to Facebook by whatever, lying about your age or whatever. Now you're a potential felon. The other big problem with the CFAA, it's not just a criminal statute, it's a civil statute. So you have all these companies now suing their employees because they don't like the way their employees used their computers. You've also got companies trying to use it for anti-competitive purposes, like Craigslist is suing a data harvester called 3Taps, I believe it is, because 3Taps went and harvested all of a bunch of Craigslist ads and then re-indexed them in a different way than Craigslist. And Craigslist is saying you can't do that. And there's a lot of actually weird anti-competitive CFAA civil litigation out there that I think nobody in Congress even thought would occur once when they wrote the statute.
So I'm curious then, I mean, is the bigger issue, you know, the idea of a protected computer, or, you know, is it the authorization of that?
The authorization, the protected computer is, this is kind of just a silly technical term because it's basically, I don't know how much you know about like the Interstate Commerce Clause in the United States Constitution, but basically almost every federal criminal law, the jurisdiction for it is predicated on the Interstate Commerce Clause, the Congress's ability to regulate interstate commerce, because they say, oh, this crime, you know, affects interstate commerce. There's a lot of people who think that theory is ridiculous, but nonetheless, it's constitutional theory, you know, for the jurisdictional hook for federal criminal law. Protected computers is any computer involved in interstate commerce, which just basically means almost any freaking thing with a microchip in it, your cell phone, you know, your telephone, your GPS in your car. Your car is probably actually a protected computer because it has so many microchips in it and it's involved in interstate commerce. So, I mean, almost anything's a protected computer. What the real issue is well, what constitutes authorized, you know, access to a computer? Nobody has a clear idea of what that means. And initially, like these computer laws, they first started emerging out of trespass, common law trespass, and the courts really struggled trying to apply common law trespass to computer law because there's obviously very big differences between the computer, the digital world, and the physical world. And you're still seeing that struggle. And the issue with the question of authorized access is it being defined like in these prosecutions, like, say, Wee's prosecution, in a way that's actually criminalizing computer use by millions of Americans? Because you could argue that if Spitler and Wee did is criminal, is really criminal, then, well, you know, Google is committing a crime, millions of crime felonies every day just by having its bots, you know, crawl the internet. So it's a very problematic case.
So what has been AT&T's role in all this? I mean, it seems like the way you've described it is that it was a public website that anybody could access. So it wasn't something that was hidden or, you know, required a password or any sort of...
It was out there in the open. It wasn't indexed. It was part of the deep web, but, it was public-facing and publicly accessible. AT&T, honestly, I don't think really has that much to do with this prosecution. I think the FBI is the, you know, Department of Justice has been watching Lee for a long time, I think, you know, just because he was such an infamous internet troll. And I think they saw this, when they saw this happen and they saw that this press happen, they saw an opportunity to take him out, and they did.
So, I mean, then let me sort of change the question a bit. I mean, what has been the Department of Justice's role in not only Weave's case, but in sort of, you know, CFAA cases in general? I mean, it seems like there's a lot of, I mean, the law is written so loosely that, you know, as a layman, I get the sense that prosecutors have a lot of sort of leeway in order to charge anybody sort of under this law, whether as conspiracy or whether as an actual violation.
Yeah, I mean, they've been really aggressively prosecuting individuals who they somehow consider hackers. You know, I think, again, I've said this a million times, hackers are the new communists for the DOJ. They, you know, there's this paranoia, fear of the unknown, I think, with, you know, Matthew and, you know, Andrew and then Aaron. What's interesting about that to me is they haven't prosecuted a single company criminally, which, you know, they can because there's countless civil CFAA suits filed every day. I'm not suggesting there should be more criminal prosecutions under the CFAA, but I think it just shows you their bias. And really, like with what happened with AT&T, nobody was really harmed. You know, the government made, I think, a what I consider to be a ridiculous argument that somehow the possession of these email addresses harmed people, even though, you know, there was no, none of these people were victim of any kind of identity theft, you know, beyond the government's allegation that somehow having someone's email address is identity theft, which again, I find a bit absurd. I just think they're being really aggressive and trying to set example, you know, prosecute individuals to set, I think, what in their mind is, you know, a deterrence example. But, you know, I think it's kind of selective prosecution on their part.
So, I mean, let me ask you then, is it easier to prosecute an individual than it is a company? I mean, it seems
probably.
Like...
I also think there's a bias at the Department of Justice that they're pro-business, which isn't necessarily wrong, but I mean, I think after Arthur Anderson was criminally prosecuted, you know, for their role in Enron's accounting, you know, that put Arthur Anderson out of business. A lot of people lost jobs, and, you know, and then the Supreme Court ultimately reversed the conviction. Well, that was, you know, too late for Arthur Anderson and all those people who lost their jobs. I also think there's a... there's another reason there's a bias. Is that a lot of people at the Department of Justice, they go into the private sector, you know, after they're done at DOJ, and they're rewarded with a really fat salary. And I honestly think one of the reasons, you know, I haven't seen any real prosecutions of any of the Wall Street banks involved in the you know, recent financial collapse is that a lot of these guys are going to work for, you know, as partners in big law firms where all these banks are going to be their client. You know, so, I mean, there's, you know, I think it's a little weird. And I also just think it is easier to prosecute an individual than it is, you know, businesses. Because businesses have a lot more power.
Yeah. So, I mean, in terms of sort of contemporary history, you know, where do we put Weave's case? I mean, in terms of, if we compare it to Matthew Keyes, and then, you know, I think the most famous or most familiar to our audience would be Aaron Swartz. I mean,
yeah, I think the thing with Swartz, I think what he did was illegal under the CFAA. Like, I think that would have been a pretty clear, simple case in terms of what he did. I mean, I know there's people who disagree with me, but, you know, he physically. And I'm not, you know, this is maybe just be an argument for them to amend the CFAA, but as it's written now, he, you know, went into that closet with a mask over his face. He tapped into routers. He was bounced off the system multiple times. He was masking his IP address. There is a much stronger argument that what Swartz did was unauthorized access. The issue with Weave's case is it's not at all clear that this is unauthorized, because it looks almost exactly like what somebody does when they type a URL into a web browser and goes on the internet. And so, you know, if what Weave did, what those, Weave and Spittler, was really Spittler, but what Weave was involved with is a felony, well then, you know, millions of web browsing Americans are committing a felony every day. You know, and you've got issues with notice, because, like, sort of like, well, what made it unauthorized in Weave's case? It's not even clear to me. Is it because AT&T said it was unauthorized after the fact, even though there was, like, no notice or warning? Because, or the government said it was unauthorized, you know, after the fact? Because under that theory, you know, you go click on a Google link and the website owner decides that they don't want you on the website, bang, you've committed a felony. And so you're at, you know, whether or not you're a computer criminal is at the subjective whim of a website owner, which is a, you know, not a good thing. You know, I don't think they understand the government, the implications of the theory that they're prosecuting people under. And they didn't stop to think, because I think they were so hot to trot to take out Weave, but they really didn't think about the broader implications, you know, for computer users in the United States. And honestly, I think there's, you know, economic implications to this case that haven't been considered. I also think this prosecution makes the internet less safe, because now security researchers aren't going to want to report their findings if they're going to think that they're going to be prosecuted for a felony. You know, for doing, you know, basic, you know, InfoSec research.
So, I mean, before we get to that, you know, the case is on appeal. You guys...
Yeah, we're in the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. We filed our brief July 1st. The government's opposition briefs are due, gosh, I can't remember, August 8th, I want to say, first week of August. They may ask us for an extension. We had amicus briefs, which are just friend of the court briefs, were filed by the Mozilla Foundation, you know, Mozilla from Mozilla Firefox. Jennifer Granick was one of the authors on that brief. She's with the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford. We had Berkman Center up at Harvard filed a friend of the court brief on our behalf. The National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers filed an amicus on our behalf, and then a group of independent InfoSec researchers filed an amicus brief on our behalf. You should go to our website, www.torekman.com. All the briefs are there if you're interested in seeing them. And so, you know, the government's going to file their opposition, then we're going to get a file a reply. And then we've asked for oral arguments. Hopefully we'll get oral arguments. You don't always get them, but this is a really important case. And then the court is going to make a decision. And either way, in my opinion, and I'm not alone in this, this is going, I think, going to be a big computer law decision, unless they bounce the case on like venue grounds. But even then, it's going to be an important venue case in relation to computer law.
Walk us through the appeal then. I mean, I think it's an interesting, you make good arguments, and sort of what you've already said in the conversation sort of come out in the appeal, that, you know, visiting the AT&T's website was authorized, so forth. I mean, walk us through the appeal a bit, sort of.
Yeah, so, I mean, essentially it's exactly what you said. It's a really simple argument. It's like, this was a public web page, and all they did was visit a public web page, right? And, you know, there was no password protection or anything on these web pages. And it, because there was no password protection or any kind of code-based restriction, visiting the website is authorized. And what we're kind of saying is, like, well, you want to make it unauthorized, then password protect it or put some kind of code-based restriction on the access, to the website, there's a bright line, simple rule. We're saying it shouldn't turn on the subjective whim of the corporation or the government, you know. And, you know, that's pretty much it. It's a really simple argument. There's also really some really tactical stuff with, you know, with the CFAA. Violating the CFAA is usually just a misdemeanor, unless you're doing it in violation of some, you know, state law or constitution or other tort. And what they did here is they said, oh, well, you also violated New Jersey's unauthorized access statute. So bang, now it's a felony. You know, you've gone from, you know, maximum 1 year to 5 years. And then, you know, they also, he was also convicted for federal identity theft, you know, because after he basically got the information, he gave it to Gawker. So they said, oh, you know, that's identity theft. But the predicate crime on the identity theft statute is the first count. So, I mean, essentially, if we went on the point that what he did wasn't unauthorized access to protect a computer, everything falls apart for the government. Everything. Because everything is just really just in this case turns on what constitutes, you know, unauthorized access to a computer. So that's really where we put our firepower. And then there's some certain things with the sentencing. Like what happened is AT&T spent $73,000 on a direct, you know, snail mailing to all its customers, even though they'd emailed all their customers with like a 99% success rate. That $73,000 they spent on a direct mailing, which, by the way, they didn't put in any evidence in for, even though they were asked by the government at the sentencing hearing, that basically added a couple of years to Wee's sentence. And, you know, because it enhanced the sentencing guideline range about 8 points. So we're attacking that because we say under the, it's our opinion under the law, that that's not the kind of loss contemplated by the CFAA. Loss and damage has to be directly related to the computer, and mailing people snail mail letters is not a loss to a computer.
So how has state law played? I mean, I'm reading the appeal as we're talking right now. I'm interested that New Jersey state law has sort of played, or at least in the appeal you mentioned New Jersey state law. So, I mean, how does state law play into the larger sort of federal architecture here? I mean, is it
elevates it to a it elevates the CFAA charge from a misdemeanor to a felony. I mean, every state in the union has an unauthorized access statute, and they're almost all modeled on the CFAA. So it's like you've got these state statutes modeled after a vague federal statute. New Jersey law, though, requires case law. There's only one case on the New Jersey unauthorized access statute that requires actually bypassing a password or some kind of code-based restriction. But, you know, I mean, it's essentially a way for them just to elevate everything into a felony, because they're always going to be able to point to a state unauthorized access statute that has been violated in any CFAA case where there's unauthorized access is at issue. So it essentially erases the misdemeanor component of the statute. Turns everything into a felony, at least the way that the government is interpreting the statute right now.
I mean, I guess this is more theory than anything, but I mean, how do you establish that something happened in a state if the crime is being committed over the internet? I mean, it seems like,
well, there's a really big venue, what's called venue issue in this case, and venue is just where you have the trial. And we raised this early on, and I think it's actually a very big issue, because Spitler was in California. Weave was in Arkansas. The servers were in Texas and Georgia. No computer traffic actually went through New Jersey. And, you know, venue is protected in the U.S. Constitution. Well, it's a constitutionally defined right in Article 3 of the main body of the Constitution and in the Sixth Amendment, I hope I'm remembering that right. of the Constitution. And basically, you have to have, the Constitution says you need to have a trial at the place where the crime occurred. Well, what's their theory for being in New Jersey? We started pressing them, you know, really early on about this, because I thought, oh, they'd be able to tell me that computer traffic went through New Jersey, but they were unable to. Their entire theory is just that people who whose email addresses were taken, about 4,000 of them were in New Jersey. So somehow they are victims of the crime, and because the crime was felt in New Jersey, you've got venue New Jersey, but I think that's a completely crackpot theory of venue, because you've now, what Joe Satcher is saying, you've now got universal venue with the CFAA case now. Any kind of situation like this where a data set is downloaded, there's going to be somebody in every state in the union. And they're, you know, that presents them with the opportunity to forum shop, you know, pick a place where they think it's going to be more favorable to the prosecution, which is the whole point of the venue clause. The, you know, the founders were being carted away, you know, for trial in England for something they did in Massachusetts. And, you know, so it's a very interesting venue point in this case. And I think they're, because they're essentially arguing that the venue could be predicated on where the effects of a crime are felt, and we're essentially saying, no, it actually has to be where the actual crime occurred.
So let's, you know, move away from the legal issues and into sort of the security issues. I mean, it seems like, you know, as somebody who does, you know, security research as a hobby, as something, you know, that interests me, I mean, you know, this case sort of scares me, because it really seems like, you know, you could get a felony or a misdemeanor based solely on, you know, accessing a website, or, you know, at the discretion of, you know, the company that owns that website. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you know, what does this do in a sort of broader, you know, picture of security research and sort of even vulnerability disclosure? I mean, is this...
I think it's disincentive for people to disclose stuff. I actually think it makes the internet less safe. I've gotten lots of calls from, you know, InfoSec researchers freaked out about this case, and honestly, they should be freaked out about this case, and that's why, you know, if you look at, you know, two of the amicus briefs, they're just full of, you know, big name security researchers saying that this case is crazy, because it goes to the heart of, you know, legitimate security research practices. And, you know, if these are felonies, well, you know, nobody's going to, well, either they're going to keep on doing it and not report what they're doing, and, you know, criminal syndicates or whomever, they're just going to exploit the flaw because it's never going to get reported. And I think the consequences are a lot worse. You know.
I mean, what does this do for bug bounty programs? I mean,
I'm sorry, what?
What does this do for sort of like bug bounty programs, or, you know, vulnerability programs? Like, sort of, you know, if you discover a vulnerability on Facebook, you can disclose it to Facebook for an X amount of dollars. So, I mean, it really seems like if the law sort of doesn't encourage people to disclose, you know, wouldn't that sort of drive up the rates of these bounty programs? Or even, I mean, as you said, I mean, people will just sit on these flaws, these, you know, vulnerabilities, and sort of, you know, keep them to themselves.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's like, what if you... that's a good question. With the, you know, you would assume that the companies like Facebook or whatever, if they're offering, you know, pay a bug bounty, then they're saying that, well, you're implicitly authorized to you know, go under our system and do security research because we're going to pay you a reward. But at the same time, you know, you're a little bit at their whim there, because say you discover something that they really don't like, or you discover some kind of major flaw that they then decide that they're going to cover up, and then you decide, oh, you're going to go, you know, publish it because the public needs to know, and then bang, they decide to, you know, call up their friends at the DOJ and have you prosecuted. You know, so I'm not quite sure what the effect is on the bug bounty thing, but, you know, you're at their whim. You know, you're at the company's whim with this interpretation of the CFAA that the government's promulgating.
So let me, for the last bit of our interview, I want to talk about, I want you to sort of deal with sort of Arnheimer's, Weaves, you know, his critics. You know, especially, I mean, and so his critics, I mean, especially in the InfoSec community, sort of boil down to sort of two strains of arguments. One is, you know, he shouldn't have got caught. You know, that's, you know, I think this line of argumentation says, you know, if you're doing gray hatting, if you're doing black hatting, there's a premium on secrecy. There's a premium on hiding and sort of making sure that nobody knows what you're doing, basically. And then the sort of the other argument that people offer is that, you know, the way he disclosed the flaw. So the way that he went to AT&T or went to Gawker was sort of loud, was sort of arrogant, was sort of, you know, bombastic. That, you know, I think this strain of argument goes that his aim, his ultimate aim, was to sort of humiliate AT&T for, you know, having...
Which isn't illegal,
right?
You know what I mean, necessarily, unless you're defaming them. But he was defaming them because he was speaking the truth. And certainly they fixed the vulnerability almost instantaneously after his criticism. And you could, you know, argue that they wouldn't have done that unless there'd been the public exposure, you know. So, and again, I think it's important to see that's all nice, you know, all the InfoSec, the white hat, the gray hat, the black hat, and everyone got their panty in a knot about, you know, what we did or didn't do or what he should have done or whatever. But, you know, the most important thing to realize about this case, it's the unauthorized access part of it. Was this unauthorized access? Because if it was, then what the white hats are doing, what the gray hats are doing, and certainly what the black hats are doing is a felony. You know, that's, you know, the reporting and how it was handled and all that stuff like that is not to me what's interesting about this case. We being a troll, that's not what's interesting to me about this case. What's interesting to me about this case is that you've potentially have this legal concept that criminalizes what, you know, ordinary computer use by millions of Americans every day, that you've got this legal precedent that's actually not only is it bad for information security on the internet, it actually may have certain economic ramifications for the computer industry. I mean, this is a really, really dangerous, dangerous interpretation of the law. And for me, a lot of, you know, the little cat fights that the white hats get in with the gray hats and the black hats get in are uninteresting in a certain sense.
So, you know, before we end the interview, we always like to give the guest, you know, the last word. You know, did we leave anything out? Do you want to, you know, put anything into the conversation? You know, give us a sort of last comment, last word.
Well, you know, I think I just said it, you know, the CFAA is a horribly written statute that was that originated out of the hysteria that the movie War Games, you know, brought on in 1984. If you read the, you know, the legislative reports, they actually reference, you know, the movie War Games. So it's sort of this hysterical reaction to things. It was a poorly, you know, written law to begin with, but at least back in 1984, it was limited to government computers and financial institutions. Over time, it's been amended by people who know nothing about computers, who really haven't thought through what they're doing when they're writing laws, and who also didn't anticipate how rapidly technology would change to the point that, you know, now we all carry computers in our pockets. It's a really poorly written, drafted law that either needs to be completely repealed or amended so that unauthorized access means bypassing a password or some sort of code-based restriction.
Well, thank you so much for coming on.
Pleasure.